start. Okay, I'm going to say this is Rose Norman, and I am interviewing Naj. Do you want to use a last name or not?
Oh, sure. I don't care.
What's the last name?
McFadden.
Naj McFadden. And by phone. And we're talking about the year and a half that she spent looking for the ideal place to live. And it was 19... She started in December of 83. And... And ended in January of 87. Well,
no, really, in July of 86.
July of 86.
In about October of 86 is when I went back to Sand Hill to Judy's land and was there. My father died, I think it was January 7th or very early in January.
Well, when I first asked you to respond to what Kate had written about how traveling dykes were idealistic nomads who bridged the communication gap during a time before the internet and cell phones. They brought news about what was going on and other often controversy or idealistic expectation. You didn't identify with that. Tell how you identified as a traveling dyke.
Well, I mean, I guess I carried news about what women I had met, what they were doing and stuff, but in terms of actual land and land dykes, I think the feeling I got anyway was they were pretty much identified, you know, knew of each other. So it wasn't like I was saying, oh, hey, there's this land group, you know, that I'd be at one women's land telling them about another women's land. They already knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not sure how that, you know, there's a lot of women's land in Oregon, and I don't really recall, like, if they all were aware of the pagoda, for instance.
Yeah.
But I spent time at the pagoda and attended LEAP and I don't know that I was. I mean, I am someone who is always telling people about what I found and what other people are doing, blah, blah, you know, what's going on other places if I'm aware of that. But I think the women's land was pretty much connected. That's the impression I have at this point anyway. Back then, even though there weren't cell phones and stuff.
And why
maybe that's incorrect. I don't know. That's just a feeling that I have.
That's interesting. And what gave you that sense? Because, I mean, you went to, what, a dozen different... Well, tell about the advertisement you published.
Well, I've been planning this trip for about 10 years and saving up for it. And so what I had some skills that I knew were needed and valuable in the lesbian community. And so I wrote this, I was a contact dyke in Lesbian Connection and had been for practically since Lesbian Connection started.
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote this letter about myself, about the skills I had, and that I was traveling, looking for the ideal place to live, or planning to travel, looking for the ideal place to live, and that I wanted to work in exchange for room and board and or money. And if anybody... you know, was interested in having me come visit them, I included a self-addressed stamped envelope that they could reply to me, and also said, you know, and if you know other lesbians that might need work, please share this letter with them. So I stayed with about 125 different women.
Wow.
During this trip, I never stayed in a motel. I never. I just went from one lesbian household to another. And a couple of women that I stayed with moved, and you know, like moved west, and I stayed with them again as I went west. And a couple of women, you know, after I stayed with them, said, "Oh, you know, well, I have a friend in Oregon," and called them up, and you know, made arrangements that then when I was there, I could stay with them. So, but that was all after the fact, after I'd met, you know, stayed with various women. But so then, from the responses I got, I planned out my route, and I let people know, you know, what my route was, and I said that I would send them a letter when I was a couple of, because I wasn't, you know, I didn't, it wasn't like I'm going to stay 5 days here and 3 days there and a week there. Mm-hmm. It was all up in the air, but I tried to stay in touch with people to let them know where I was with letters and postcards, so that they would have some sense of when I would be at their, you know, and obviously as that got, you know, as I got closer to a particular destination, I would communicate more with someone, but yes, I didn't have a phone or anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were no there were cell phones, but not many people had.
Yeah. You know, and I could share with them. I mean, I could send them a letter and say, oh, I just got, and I was, a friend of mine was handling, in Indiana, was handling all my bills and correspondence and stuff. So people could call her, and, you know, I would always call her when I, got ready to leave a place and give her my next destination. And then I would call her when I got to that destination so that she always knew where I was in the route and how to reach me, you know. I mean, because I was staying with people, you know, she always mm-hmm. had an address or a phone number.
Mm-hmm. That's really well thought out.
Except for when I was driving, and it that became, I hadn't owned a car until for many years until I did this trip, and when I started out driving, oh, I was terrified. I probably stopped the car 5 times. Of course, I had bought a $500 car too for this trip. But I probably stopped the car 5 times before I went 100 miles, pulled off the road, just sure that the car was falling apart and stuff. And so when I started out, the driving was just very nerve-wracking for me. But it got so the driving was very valuable time because that was my only time when I was, you know, had total privacy when I was alone.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I was, you know, in somebody else's home and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. Not that I wasn't alone. And I mean, some people, sometimes I was in somebody's house and they would go to work or whatever, but,
yeah.
But, yeah, so that I'd be alone in their house, but
mm-hmm.
the being in the car was like really my like being able to go to my own room and close the door. Again, that has nothing to do with what you're kind of looking for, but...
That's an interesting observation, though.
And
we are planning a longer... We are hoping to be able to do a longer book. This special issue is limited by, you know, what they can publish as the magazine, but we may be able to get some funding to go from the magazine to a book, and so I'm collecting a lot more than we're going to publish right away.
Now I do remember, like, Martine and Miriam, Martine and Miriam were the two women from Canada, and we kept running into each other all over Florida, and that was really neat. I enjoyed that, and we did. I do remember us sharing information about, oh yeah, go visit this land, or go, you know, go look up this person outside Gainesville or Florida or whatever, and. Like they came, when I was at Sandhill, they came to Sandhill when I came back to Sandhill, you know, before my father died. They came to Sandhill and visited, you know, I guess the information that I felt like I was really sharing was with other traveling dykes that I'd run into, you know,
Let me ask, what made you decide to go on the road looking for an ideal place to live? You said you planned it for 10 years. What took you there? How did you know about Women's Lands and all?
I guess probably from Lesbian Connection. I had worked with the Michigan Women's Music Festival Collective, the second or third festival. I think it was the second one. It was probably in 77. So I'm not sure when. Let's see. So
next year,
15 is going to be the 40th. So it would have been 75. Would have been the first one.
Yeah.
Or 76. I don't know. Anyway, second or third one. It was outside Hesperia, Michigan. I went and worked there, and I had always been. I had lived communally, was interested in living communally, had been involved in radical lesbian feminist movement, and that's where my heart lay. Plus, I considered myself kind of a country person. I mean, all my relatives were farmers, and I come from a long line of farmers, and like living in the country. I bought my first house. I bought for $8,250, and I spent 3 years totally remodeling it, and really wanted to do stuff. I mean, I really wanted to build my own house from the ground up, and I wanted to do it and do things like, you know, hand carve the windowsills and stuff like that. You know, stuff that, I mean, you'd spend the rest of your life building the house. I mean, not that it wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't have a frame up and stuff that you could live in, but just making it yours. So I hate moving. I wanted to find the ideal place to live and live there for the rest of my life. So that was my That was my motivation. That's what I was looking for. And I knew it wasn't in Indiana.
Okay.
Although I may end up dying here.
Oh, wow. So it's been Indiana for the last too many years.
I told someone the other day that if I die in Indiana, while I'm still living in Indiana, I'll consider it the single biggest failure of my life.
Oh. Oh, so that's the last 25 years of your life you've lived there. More than that.
Pardon?
You've lived now in Indiana the last 25 years?
Yes.
14 months. 27
and
years.
And believe me, those 25 years went really fast.
Yeah. Okay, so that's how your idealism. All right. Now, this project we're doing, the Southern Lesbian Feminist Activist First Free Project, you know, is about documenting all the stuff that was going on in the South that's not gotten recognized by the historians of the women's movement, who tend to focus on urban Northeast and Western places.
Mm-hmm.
And we see the Landike movement as a form of lesbian feminist activism, you know, partly because of just creating this alternative world where you could live out the feminist values. So you said earlier you saw yourself as a lesbian feminist activist. And did you see this as a... I know you said you were looking for the ideal place to live, but did you see it as a form of activism too? Or tell about your activism.
What is activism?
Oh, you know, what kind of radical... When you said you were already a feminist...
Well, I didn't see the traveling as radical, but I saw... I mean... Women's land, yes, and women living on it, yes, I saw that as a radical act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as much as one could, dropping out of the mainstream and creating our own environments and stuff. Now, at the end of my traveling, I was kind of disillusioned about that, but
mm-hmm.
but yes, that's you know, my vision originally was that, yes, I saw that as a very radical political activity.
And what was your radical politics before you started doing that?
Well, I'd lived in New York City, and I'd been a part of radical feminists and Women's Music Network that put out the record Lavender Jane Loves Women. And we were doing dances and concerts with women, you know, with the lesbian performers. You know, and it was all, at that time, all women, and all women played the music, and... you know, I thought we were doing something very different. I didn't think we were just trying to create a lesbian Mick Jagger.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, I think what's happened with women's music is it's just become mainstream. You know, it's not what I thought it was to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, I was involved in things like, I was involved in things beyond just lesbian politics. I was also involved with this group in New York City that organized rent strikes and helped, you know, it was much more of a kind of a Marxist group.
Mm-hmm.
But the radical lesbian feminist was really where was what was really personal for me, and my attitude was the personal is political, that how we how we would get things changed, how we would create change was by changing things in our own lives. Mm-hmm. And that being not an example isn't exactly the right word, but that being, you know, that as things in our lives changed, for instance, women's land, that women living on women's land, the more women that were living on women's land, the more other women could see that, well, that's a possibility. Yeah, yeah. I could do that too, you know. So
yeah.
In a sense, an example, and that's how change was created, more so than voting, you know, or boycotting or whatever.
Yeah.
And that was my personal political philosophy back then.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, let me...
Now, I saw, you know, the South seemed to have a lot of women's land, a fair amount of women's land. I kind of felt like when I left New York City, about anything or everything you could want to find, you could find in New York City. And I left there in 75. But what I discovered and thought was that, but incredible radical things are happening all over, like Lesbian Connection and the Michigan Women's Music Festival, which was different than it is now. I mean, for one thing, it was a collective back then. You know, like the Pagoda. I mean, I thought the Pagoda was just really fantastic, you know, and really exciting. But the Pagoda was a rare place because everybody was an owner, whereas most women's land, what was defined as women's land, except for one or two places in Oregon, really was privately owned land. And the owner, whoever the actual owner was, really had the right at any point to kick people off, and that's exactly what they did at certain points. And that, when I was traveling, I found that very depressing and scary. I mean, I would have been very hesitant to build my own house, you know, on somebody else's land, on land that I didn't really have any ownership in, or you know, that somebody could just kick me off if I pissed them off.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah, you know, when did you know Blue London? Did you go down there to Sugar Land?
Yes, I knew Blue from but I knew Blue from New York City.
Oh, right, of course.
But I did visit her in Sugarloaf Key.
Well, that's interesting,
yeah.
Because you know when they were trying, she was dying, and they were trying to talk her into putting the land in a land trust, and she told more than one person that she was resisting it because she was afraid that then they might kick her off if she didn't own it.
Well, she did go back to New York City to die, didn't she?
No, she died at Sugarloaf.
Mm-mm. Did she?
Died at Sugarloaf in that house.
Was she in New York some of the time? Because a good friend of mine helped care for her, and I'm pretty sure she did it in New York.
Well, she might have had some caregiving in New York, but a whole bunch of people went down to Sugarloaf to care for her in her last days.
Well, I'll have to, I need to call Callie because I need a recipe from her for a cranberry salad, but I'll ask her about that. Because this particular person I knew from when I lived in Des Moines, and so it was neat that someone I knew from New York City and then someone I knew from Des Moines, Iowa, connected up and knew each other well.
That's interesting crossings.
I had this whole list of what would make a place a perfect place to live for me.
Yeah.
And on the top of the list was, well, one high up on the list was that it not snow. And that's why it was so ironic that every place I went, I got snowed in.
And that was in the south?
The first place. I wasn't snowed in there, but my car wouldn't start. It was so cold.
Where was that?
And, I mean, it even snowed in Phoenix when I was in Phoenix. I think, again, didn't get snowed in Phoenix, but it snowed in Phoenix, you know, which just doesn't happen. So the joke was that I was bringing, you know, me trying to get away from snow was bringing it with me everywhere I went. But at Sugarloaf, I was working on a ceiling in the guest house, and it was July, I think. It was the middle of the summer, and I came down off the ladder, and it was noticeably cooler. And that's when I realized on my during my trip that, yeah, I don't like snow, and it's a pain in the ass to drive in and everything, but the heat will kill you a lot faster than the cold will. So that was, you know, many things on my list changed as I traveled and experienced other realities.
Can you think of other traveling dykes you met other than Miriam and Martine?
It's not Mary Ellen. Miriam.
Yeah, she pronounces it Miriam.
Oh, Miriam. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a French pronunciation.
You know, not really, although if... You know, I should drag out my journals and go through them.
Well, you know, after I type this up, you may be moved to do that because you may want to, you know, play with it and do something with it. And I'm thinking this whole interview it might inspire you to write something else or more. It can go probably in the book. We're only going to be able to use a small part. You know, maybe we'll. You know, some quotations from several traveling dykes or something.
Sure.
I'm not sure. I'm going to send this to Kate when I send it to you and see whether she can think of, I mean, I'm thinking about Blue Jay. Do you know Blue Jay? She lives out west.
Oh, well, no. Where does she live?
Arf, I think.
Yes, I've met her.
Mm-hmm.
I've met her out at Wee Moon.
Yeah, she travels a lot. I mean, she has land, but she travels a great deal. And, you know, she's not Southern, but I know she lived in the South. I'm just trying to think of some other traveling dykes we could interview to get some different perspectives on, you know, what the experience was like. And this is a very good one. I mean, it's and the fact that you were so organized, you know, about... sending self-addressed stamped envelopes to people. How did you get addresses to do that? What did you do?
lesbian connection.
Oh, you sent them to contact Dykes.
There wasn't email, so people had phone numbers and or addresses. Mm-hmm. You know, all the contact Dykes had addresses or a phone number because, and most of them had addresses because, you know, there wasn't email.
Yeah.
Now, you know, everybody just has email, maybe a phone number, sometimes an address. And it's also interesting that I did the self-addressed stamped envelopes because, you know, I had not had much money, a lot of money in my life, and I figured, well, if I want people to respond to me, I should make it free for them to do that. So, hopefully if they don't want to respond to me, they can use the stamped envelope for something else.
Do you feel like you've said what you've got on your mind right now?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't, you know, I fell in love with Florida and the women in Florida. And, I mean, Leap was very powerful, and I guess what I started to say and didn't finish was that women were doing incredible things, all over the country, and it was something different. You know, I mean, some things were the same all over the country, but each area of the country seemed to have, you know, their own thing. I found that very exciting, and I personally really clicked with the women in around Gainesville, with Barb and Barbara, her partner, who's still in the Miami area, really clicked with them, and you know, we talked about forming community together, but the problem was none of us had any money.
Yeah,
you know? So. I mean, I probably would have thought before this trip, I probably would have thought that, gee, if somebody bought the land and said, come on and live on it, that's great. That, what more could you ask for? And yet, as I experienced it traveling around, that's when I got a whole nother sort of feeling about it. And realized that usually, when land was privately owned, the person who owned it wasn't willing to. Well, like Judy's land, you know, men weren't allowed on that land until Judy got a lover that had a teenage son.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he was allowed there, and anybody who didn't like it didn't need to come to the land, and in fact, they wanted the land to be more private, and I'm not sure where Margaret Waters is, but I've heard that, I'm not on Facebook, but I've heard that Sandra's on Facebook.
Yeah.
Sandra. Do you know Sandra?
Sandra who?
I'm trying to think of her last name.
Sandra.
She was at Karis.
Oh, Lambert.
Books.
Yes. Yeah, I do.
Yeah, Lambert. Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, Sandra Lambert. So you know Sandra?
Yeah. In fact, somebody in Gainesville is interviewing her for us. We're doing a third issue on cultural feminism with bookstores and stuff, and somebody's getting an interview with her about Karis.
So, where is she? I'd really like to get in touch with her.
She's in Gainesville? Well,
she is in Gainesville?
Either she's in Gainesville or in one of those towns that's not far from Gainesville. You know, like Hawthorne or Melrose.
Right.
Yeah. People in Gainesville have mentioned your name. When you said who you were, I immediately recognized having heard your name. I was at that Wee Moon gathering last fall, too. Were you there?
Yes.
Seemed like your name came up there, too, maybe.
Yeah. So, well, what do you look like?
I don't look like a land dyke. I look like a narc.
Like a what?
I look like I'm infiltrating the I don't look like a land dyke. I have this problem with not looking like I fit in.
Well,
I don't think I'm very memorable looking.
Where did you camp?
I didn't camp. I was staying in Salem. That's how I got to go. Was I had a friend who was going to a workshop in Salem, and I flew out with her. And then I drove over to Wee Moon Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So I didn't really get to meet people because I wasn't camping.
Okay, so but where did you sleep? Did you drive over there from Salem during the day?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's not a good way to meet people.
Yeah. I was the one who kept losing my clothes.
Really?
I don't know. I was there for a week, so. Yeah. But I'm no. If something isn't attached to me, I lose it.
Yeah.
Nowadays, and one day it was sunny, and I took my clothes off, and then lost them, and people were helping me try to find them. But.
They have great thrift stores out there. We had some good thrift shopping out there.
Yeah. I know. I spent 2 months in Portland last winter.
Yeah.
And I can't do that kind of shopping much because standing now is difficult for me, but for long periods of time. But I did go thrift shopping once and got 2 great jackets and a shirt and a couple of shirts and a pair of shoes and really made some good scores that I've been wearing a lot lately. So where are you right now?
I live in Huntsville, Alabama.
Okay.
Yeah, we have land in Sewanee, Tennessee. But only there's a group of 6, and only one of us lives on the land.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't have any utilities, you know. And the 5 of us live here in Huntsville,
right,
within like blocks of each other. It just got to be where, you know, nobody wanted to sell their house and move out into the country that far away from where all our connections are.
Uh-huh.
It's an old story.
Well, you know, now that we're getting older, I mean, that's. I don't feel capable or have the desire to live out. I mean, I'd love to live out in the country, but like I don't feel capable of heating with wood and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I just couldn't live out there in Oregon like they do. And when I lived in Kansas City for a little over a year, and that was back in 75, 76, and the women there were buying and or renting houses in this one neighborhood.
Womantown.
So that was really cool. I mean, and that's, I mean, I wish we could organize that kind of thing again.
Yeah.
Or here in Indianapolis, there's a lot of, buildings that are just abandoned, really neat buildings that I would love to, you know, if I had a ton of money, it'd be great to rehab one of them and have it be apartments with a common area, you know, on each floor with a kitchen and, you know, big area for that could handle meetings or parties or whatever. you know, on each floor.
Yeah.
I mean, because nobody, you know, like, we don't all need our own washer and dryer and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. We could certainly share share that, things, but
that was our
it has
idea.
To be convenient.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now, you know, the sad thing is the whole, I mean, what I saw out in Oregon, the younger women nowadays, they don't, women's space is not of value to most of them.
Mm-hmm.
The land, they love the land at Weemoon and stuff, but they didn't, they don't, things have changed so that they don't feel the need to, you know, they're definitely not separatists.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't feel any need to be a separatist. And that's, I mean, I suppose that's a sign of how roles have changed and you know, society's changed. So I should take that as a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's kind of, I feel like we're a dying breed.
Yeah. Well, we've interviewed some young, like 30s, 40s dykes, and one 20-something who lives at Weemoon. And there are some who have sort of the same values that we did. They're coming along behind us. Of course, they still don't have any money.
Who did you interview that's 20-something at Weemoon?
Her name is Eva, and she moved out there this summer with her partner.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, they moved from, they were at Twin Oaks for a while.
Yeah, they were, yeah.
But they, did you read about, are you on the grapevine, or do you get the notices from that? I mean, I think it's neat that she, I've never met her.
Uh-huh.
I really wanted to, because I visited Twin Oaks when I was traveling, and I was really impressed.
Uh-huh.
Wait, they have it down.
Yeah.
Communal living down.
Yeah.
And, but so I really wanted to be able to meet her and her partner and just talk with them about Twin Oaks and why they left and you know what they thought of it now, because it's been, you know, 30 years since I was there.
Yeah.
Did you see the thing she was organizing for summer solstice? No, maybe it wasn't. I don't know if it was summer solstice, but she organized a little festival and brought some performer up from California.
I didn't see that.
Okay. Yeah, it was going to be like, I can't, you know, I'm going to get the figures wrong, but she was going to pay this performer something like $1,500, and so, you know, to come out to Weemoon for the weekend for this, it was going to be $300 or $400. And I read that and I just thought, wow, I don't know anybody who is at Weemoon who's going to go mm-hmm. to Weemoon and, you know, going to spend $300 or $400 for a weekend at Weemoon.
Yeah.
And I called up several of the women that were involved with the land and said, what do you think? And they all said, I'm not going.
Oh.
I can't afford to go.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a, you know, I mean, everything was always, here's the price, more if you can, less if you can't.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I believe in that strongly.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the Weemoon, the whole Weemoon, I was at Weemoon for 10 days, I guess, and what was it, $40 or something for food for the week?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean,
right.
I gave them more money than that because I could do that, but like, you know, and
yeah.
This woman was going to turn around and charge. So she values women only space.
She wrote something that the focus of the piece was the it's called The Ache, and it was about why she's now at Women. She came, she started feeling this ache for lesbian only space. Yes, or women. Okay. Women.
Well,
I'm not sure.
I wondered if that maybe had something to do with why she left. Why they left
Twin Oaks.
The one, I mean, the thing that amazed me about Twin Oaks was the, you know, 30 years ago, was that the men weren't like typical men, and the women weren't like typical, the men weren't like typical straight men, and the women weren't like typical straight women. So I was really blown away, because I could have never, I could have stayed at Twin Oaks, and I could have never envisioned me being able to do that, being in a mixed community. You know, so I was really kind of blown away by Twin Oaks. But there was only one other lesbian there when I visited. I mean, I was visiting her.
Who was the other lesbian?
I can't tell you her name. I'd have to go back and look through my... She was a contact dyke and lesbian connection.
I see.
She was from California, because she, in a conversation... I was very close with my grandmother, and in conversations with her, she was lamenting that she had not... gotten more information from her grandmother, and her grandmother was out in Sherman Oaks or something like that, Thousand Oaks, California.
Yeah.
When I went up the coast of California, I went and spent a day with her grandmother and tape recorded.
Oh.
And sent this woman the tapes.
Wow. That was great. What a great gift to give that person.
Yeah. It was neat. It was fun. I enjoyed meeting her, her grandmother. You know, I mean, my grandmother was an amazing woman, and unfortunately, a lot of the information and knowledge that she had, I wasn't interested in when. Mm-hmm. When she was really at the top of her game, and by the time I really realized, wow, you know, she's got information that's going to die with her. You know, she was not quite so with it to be able to impart that. So
yeah.
I've always been real aware of how valuable that information is when somebody's got it, you want to get it.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. That's what our project is all about. All of these old dykes who were doing so much in the 70s and 80s and 90s are dying. So we got to get their stories.
Yeah, that's right. I read the, you know, the first thing in Sinister Wisdom.
And
I told Barb, Esther, I said, the one thing that I didn't like about a lot of it was just a chronology of dates, and this happened, and I said, gee, what I really wanted to read was, you know, what Corky had to say about the North 40 and Pat, you know, her the other woman who was living there full time, and more personal. You know, what I personally was interested in reading was personal, you know, people's personal stories. And there was some of that in Sinister Wisdom, and I really enjoyed that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, you know, I hope this brings out more, more of that.
We do have a lot of personal stories in this one. We have... Corky talking about the North 40. And we have something about Womantown, which is at Kansas City. The people who started Womantown, that lesbian neighborhood in Kansas City, wrote or are part of a project.
Paula Marie Dotter, one of them?
I know who that is, but no, that's not.
Well, she lives out. She lives in Missouri or Arkansas, someplace like that now.
Yeah.
Susan Weishart knows Paula Marie Daughter, mm-hmm. but Paula lived in Kansas City when I was there, huh. and was she was a flight attendant, huh. and doing a lot of organizing of stewardesses, you know, to get them to be called flight attendants and get them the respect they deserved and stuff. And yeah, she was definitely a big part of the community there.
Mm-hmm. Susan did write a story about her for Hawk Hill for us. Susan wrote something.
And Clay, do you know Clay?
No.
Clay.
Okay.
Well, Clay's out at Autumn. She's been out at. She was at Wee Moon.
Yeah.
The Wee Moon celebration and. She's at ARF now, but she lives very near Susan.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody on the listserv not very long ago, somebody was asking, the woman in Iowa that's got the farm was asking if anybody had Clay's phone number.
Hmm.
And Susan Weishart wrote in and said, "Where is Clay?"
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, anyway, everybody got connected up. And but Clay's out at, she built a house. Clay's a very skilled builder,
mm-hmm.
and she built a house near Susan Weishart, so she's in that same vicinity.
Mm-hmm.
But she travels a lot. She's been going and spending the winters in Florida working, doing a lot of remodeling work for women in around the Gainesville area, Hawthorne. And
mm-hmm.
do you know Jenna Worth?
Jenna Weston?
Yeah, Jenna Weston, I mean.
She wrote about gathering root. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she, Clay has spent two winters, remodeling Jenna's house down there and outside Hawthorne.
Mm-hmm.
And, but Clay might be a good one to write. I mean, I don't know what her history is, like, she's younger than I am, and how much traveling she did back in the years, you know, that you're mm-hmm. wanting, but she does a lot of traveling and a lot of, you know, goes around to a lot of different lands and stuff, so she might be a good person to contact. Would you like her phone number?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. Let me look it up just a minute. She's in-ground swimming pool. It was two professors. And another place I stayed was, you know, a dirt floor house with no electricity and an outhouse, and you know, so I mean, I really stayed in a wide variety of places
mm-hmm.
with a wide variety of people.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think if you were to find those journals, you might be able to cook up something really, really, really more, even more detailed and interesting out of this. So I'm hoping that sending you these notes will encourage you to go back and think about it and try to take your mind back there and maybe
write some about it. See what I can do.
Okay, well, I need to let you go now, but I will be in touch with these notes.
Okay.
And